Given the introduction to the previous speaker, or given by the previous speaker, I think I would qualify here as a barbarian. But happily, I will add that well-mannered, basically, in law. What I want to bring to you today are some ideas, and I patterned the lecture in a manner that would be most effective with applied mathematicians and physicists, but I see the makeup here is rather different, and so I'm going to adjust it as we go on. And I want to focus on certain ideas. There's a motivation here underlying this, having to do with how individuals taken together in a complex fashion, especially in hierarchies of different sorts that can emerge in natural ways, can undergo a pattern of self-organization, and that self-organization can give structure where you would not otherwise see it, and you can identify what is happening in a broader scale. And this can have manifestations in a temporal, spatial, and also size distribution sense. It embodies issues. In past lecture, I noticed references to cellular automata. We'll talk a lot about that, to fractals, to networks, etc. This all emerges. And I'm going to begin by providing a little bit of a review of cellular automata percolation, ideas that emerged originally nearly four centuries ago in applications to epidemiology, became of substantial importance in physics in the last several decades. And we'll take a look at some other ways that this can manifest. And I want to draw to your attention two rather different problems, which I believe bear on this, as we'll see. We'll be speaking metaphorically, but we're going to see those metaphors do remarkably well in reproducing observed statistics in the context of forest fires, context of earthquakes, and I claim possibly in the context of gang recruitment. So let me feed you a little tidbit here to get you thinking, an idea to chew over, and that is, if you were to imagine taking a region, and let's forget for the moment about the complications of spatial heterogeneity and complexities of neighborhoods and so on, suppose everything was uniform. Suppose you imagine dividing it up into small little tracts. You may want to think of it as individual homes or blocks and neighborhoods. You may also want to think of it in terms of parcels of land where you could be introducing seedlings, you're planting trees. You could be imagining some rock strata in which you're introducing stress. And then the question that emerges is, this happens in a random way. And I should leave you then with the notion that perhaps we can also be introducing into this the notion of recruitment of gang members. How collectively will this action result in large-scale behavior? So we'll segue to two seemingly unrelated problems, which have a statistical scaling, which we are now able to predict mathematically, and corresponds to what's seen in nature. So the quote due to Tesla, notwithstanding, you can build models based on data, I'm concerned about that. And then I'm going to present some data. In fact, that has been one of our frustrations. We wanted to look at data relevant to LA, and my colleagues Turcott and Kellis-Borok have tried to obtain this in the past, so I hope one outcome of this meeting is that I will learn where we can find such data. But the applied mathematician and hydrodynamicist Lewis Fry Richardson, over half a century ago, obtained data for gangland Chicago and for Manchukuo, Japanese occupied Manchuria, and showed statistical distribution of sizes of gangs and activity as a function of the size, and we are able to reproduce that theoretically. And with the same class of models that gives us behavior that's observed for forest fires and to a lesser extent for earthquakes. So let me begin. Just a couple comments for the more mathematically inclined here. Whenever we think of mathematics, and here I think Tedla's quote is applicable, we often think of differential equations. We have to think in a different way. We have to start thinking about individuals, individual components, and how they interact. So the notion of a continuous system and so on is not all that useful. However, having said that, discrete models can be amenable to probabilistic methods in mathematics, graph theoretic methods, computer science can be brought to bear. I will show model results where we've had a billion elements. You can do things in these models where traditional methods fail. We'll see behavior that introduces fractals, etc. This emerges in a natural way and underscores the complexity of the underlying situation. There are technical issues involved, I won't dwell on those, but my claim then is there are potential benefits to the applications that are very great, but also feeding back into mathematics. There are problems that can be addressed more readily by these discrete phenomenological models and at the same time, this could be an important testbed for encouraging mathematicians and physicists to look as well at new ways of thinking about these problems. So the barbarians at the gate may in fact be very welcome recipients of the notions that you're describing here. Well, cellular automata have enjoyed a rather intriguing history. It goes back to von Neumann's times in the 1940s and earlier with Turing, trying to develop theoretical or hypothetical devices that could reproduce itself in a theoretical sense. The Cambridge mathematician John Conway combined certain aspects of a group theoretical problem with von Neumann's idea of a machine, even if it was only in paper, that could reproduce itself and devise the game of life, which appeared for the first time in the fall issue of Scientific American. This is very intriguing. I'll show you a couple of clips from it, but this, in fact, has certainly all the charm of a video game, but much more, because you can introduce into these, you're looking at how different entities, and translate that into human beings, interact with one another, etc., and what that does. So in some sense, you're introducing a collection of cells and a few rules describing how they interact and how there might be some initial behavior or conditions that are present and how they produce complex patterns. The origins of some of these ideas go back to biology and epidemiology centuries earlier, formed the foundation of what is called percolation theory. So here's a screen dump from Conway's Game of Life, and you see these different structures that can reproduce themselves in different ways. But in the context of gangs, I'd like you to imagine, for instance, that each of these filled-in elements corresponds to a gang member, and the associations, the hierarchy, the clustering that appears. The earliest illustration of this problem area goes back to the 1600s. And corresponds to a very practical problem, and that of planting an orchard on a square grid. And imagine, if you will, that there is an infectious disease present, and a certain small fraction of plants has it, but your concern is that is one of limiting the spread of the disease if you're looking at clusters of trees within this orchard so that not all of them are infected. You want to limit the size of the clusters so this doesn't happen. On the other hand, you want to maintain as a larger fraction as practical of sites occupied. Sid?
Yeah, this is just a historical question. I don't think Ray Horvath was around in the
1600s. No, Ray definitely wasn't around. he was a former vice chancellor, provost here. He definitely wasn't.
What is the right history?
But he did not pose the question, but he brought it to our attention. let me try to describe this through a picture. And apologize, the elements of the picture are small, but each of these panels corresponds to a collection of squares. If they're white, they're unoccupied. If they're black, they're filled. And what we've done in achieving each of these is we've selected with a certain probability, in this first case 35%, that a given square is occupied. So randomly selecting squares, 35% of these in this box are occupied, and you don't see any particular pattern, and there's no essential connectivity. So if you planted an orchard like this, and you were concerned about, forget it. I was going to make some comment about the Mediterranean fruit fly, but that doesn't work. But the disease would be, if a given cluster had a disease manifest, it would not spread beyond that cluster. It would be limited in space as to how far it would travel. You go to 50% of the sites occupied, and you see the clusters become larger and larger. Yes?
So all your rules are local? All your rules of transition?
Yes,
would be
yes,
local.
These are local.
Right.
You can build non-local ones, but that's...
You're saying you're starting with 35% of the cells occupied?
35% are occupied. And randomly, looking...
35?
Okay. What I've done here is I've gone and looked at each cell individually. I roll my computational dice, and I say with 35% likelihood, if I get a certain number, if it's above 35%, I generate a random number between 0 and 1. If it's below 0.35, I occupy the site. If it's above, I do not.
Each site independently.
Each site independently. And that's important. It isn't dependent. Here, we go to 50%, and you see the cluster sizes have increased. 59%, something magical occurs. They've linked up. They've spanned the entire grid. And then 76%, it's becoming a very much a filled pattern. So epidemiology, at least in this mathematical picture, questions in solid state physics, conductivity, porosity in fluid flow and solid media, etc., can't be described this way. Let me suggest a different way of achieving a rather similar result. Suppose for a moment I start off with a square whose individual cells are unoccupied, and then randomly I plant, if you will, each of the sites. I select a site at random. Now, I could be depositing there a seedling for looking at a forest or orchard. I could be depositing stress, we're worried about earthquakes, or I could be recruiting a gang member. And then as time passes, I continue doing this, and as time passes, the same kind of pattern will emerge, one wherein we are looking at higher probability of occupancy of the sites. And something then, once we get to this special level, magical occurs, you get the connection, and something can then occur. If, for example, this was an electrical network and I had sources of charged particles in either end, I could get flow. I could get flow of water. I was looking at flow of fluids in a permeable medium. So I want to go from this initially static picture to a dynamic one, because the dynamic is what really concerns us. I want to present a different picture now, which has attracted a lot of attention. The previous one that I presented, looking at the time dependence, corresponds closely to what's come to be known as a forest fire model. You're planting seedlings, and then every so often a match is magically dropped, or inappropriately dropped, and if it falls on a cluster of trees, that cluster will burn. If it falls in a vacant area, nothing happens. Here instead, you have the magic hand of Per Bach depositing grains of sand at each site randomly. And there are certain rules he established wherein if a pile at a given location having accumulated multiple grains of sand exceeds a certain height, that pile will be redistributed. And what kind of pattern will this produce? And this has been basis of a considerable body of literature having to do with so-called self-organized criticality. There are elements of this that are highly controversial, but a very important contribution to modern physics. The forest fire model has been called self-organized critical. And in a paper that my colleagues and I published, I guess now 8 years ago, we were able to show analytically, there was a theorem, that it's not self-organized critical, but we could derive formally all of the observed scaling rules. I don't want to go back here. Let's go back to the percolation picture now, evolving a time where we're planting trees, or alternatively, if you wish, we are recruiting gang members. And so let's look at this landscape. And the occupied gray sites have already, if you will, a gang member present. A new site becomes occupied, denoted by an X that's isolated. This individual is operating on his own. In this next panel, we imagine that the recruitment has taken place. adjacent to or joining a pre-existing cluster, and that individual now becomes a member of this gang. And then at the last panel, we're looking at the recruitment having taken place between two pre-existing clusters and forming a bridge of building on them. Now, we have this very simple picture. What will it give? Well, unless there's some mechanism for limiting the growth of the gang, the forest, the stress of the earth, it will go on ad infinitum until everybody is recruited. So let's imagine, okay, the forest fire case, there is a fire, and that can there are a variety of ways that can happen in nature and also in terms of intervention, and that can control the overall size scale. But let's pursue that now for a moment. I want to also make a comment here that with the planting of those seeds, recruiting of gang members, it lends itself very readily to the formation of networks. So graph theoretic basis also emerges here. And I'm going to skip some of the technical slides. And here I want to show results of simulations. I don't have in my slides here, I neglected to include it, but I have, in fact, some images, but data from forest fires collected by the British Columbia Forestry Department over many years, and you get the same power laws. Let me explain how this curve works, because this is a rather unusual kind of plot. Think of the vertical axis as representing the number of events, or in this case, forest fires, involving an area larger than the position you're looking at. So if these were, say, square miles, for instance, then the vertical scale tells you what number or what fraction, because everything is logarithmic, of events of forest fires have a size of 10 square miles or larger. It's a cumulative statistical distribution, but it's done in a manner that is somewhat counterintuitive, but this is something that has been done for half a century in some applications in the physical sciences. What I want to draw your attention to is the slope here. In each case, a power law falls off essentially as 1 over the area. It falls off just a little bit faster than that, minus 1.1, minus 1.2, or so on. These other numbers and the different curves correspond to how frequently a match has been dropped. And that has very little effect on the overall scaling. What it simply has done is tells you that the less frequently you drop a match, the larger the clusters of trees can emerge, which burn. I'm waiting for to display the next slide.
What would match in this case? Lightning strikes?
Lightning strikes, for instance. But you could also apply this, and in fact, the Forest Service has been pursuing us, and especially my colleague John Turcotte, in depth about some of the results. This may actually affect intervention policies. The point here, in the past, in the last couple of decades, the Forest Service basically tried to stamp out any fires, period. And that allowed clusters of trees and the underbrush to grow to extremely large areas, and meant when there was a major fire, it would be almost uncontrollable. And so given these scalings and their observation, we can build policy as to what is the most economic way and least dangerous way of handling the situation. So there is an intervention that is possible in this instance. Is there one possible for gangs based on size distributions?
I'm sorry, I still don't understand the limiting rule. So we have things which are occupying,
mm-hmm.
at some rate.
Okay, there are a number of possible rules.
But
the one demonstrated was you drop a match for every, say, 500 runs. Trees, planted, you drop a match for every 2,000 trees dropped. That corresponded to the different curves shown. Another scheme, which I'll describe momentarily, is we'll now move from the metaphor of planting trees to introducing stress. And stress on essentially the continental crust in different regions, and looking at what happens if the area that is formed, that is stressed, that connects up, as we have seen in a cluster, spans a large region, for example, of the San Andreas Fault. And I'll show you in a couple minutes some actual data from Parkfield, the Parkfield earthquakes, that fits this. Okay, I don't claim there's any intervention possible there, but the same statistic applies. We're looking at a self-organizing principle that is an outcome largely of geometry, which makes it universal. And other factors can will influence it, but the underlying issue will largely be determined by fundamentally geometrical principles. I'm waiting for...
No, it already went by.
It already
by.
Went
by.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me go back. Okay, this one. This is a fragment of a 1 billion element simulation. And the different colors describe different levels in the hierarchy of sites that are occupied. So in terms of networking and hierarchical organization, there's a tremendous wealth of information you can obtain in this class of models. Here, two sets of six panels. Here are six realizations for the forest fire problem, where no matches are tossed in until a given cluster spans the entire system. So we observe here the cluster in red, which is now consumed by flame, extends from the right boundary to the left. And the white sites are ones that are unoccupied. The green sites are those occupied trees that have not been involved in the fire. So different realizations of it. You see the complexity of the pattern formed. And the problem of initiating this process, for instance, of waiting until, suppose you start off with a blank slate and you start planting trees. And you ask how long will it take until you span the network. That's a standard problem in probability theory you give to undergraduates. But suppose now, when that first happens, you have a fire that eliminates all those trees that are connected, going from one end to the other. Or in this case, we're looking at what are called characteristic earthquakes, large-scale events. And in the aftermath of the fire or the earthquake, you see the area previously occupied has been vacated. And you resume now the process of planting trees, or of adding stress, or of recruiting gang members. And you see there's a predisposition to fill the unoccupied areas. One rule that applies in this picture is that an occupied site cannot be planted on top of unless a tree has been eliminated. And you see the following conflagration occupies a rather different region. There is some memory as to what happened earlier. And this changes the timing. I won't go into the mathematics, but let me just show for earthquakes. These are the distribution observed in Parkfield, a region of a special interest because in the San Andreas Fault, the fault undergoes a very curious bend, which is a locking point. And the distribution of earthquakes follows not a Poisson distribution, but a so-called Weibull distribution. The models that I've been describing with cellular automata reproduce that extraordinarily well. It's intriguing. Such a simple model, and the fundamental aspect of it, again, is it's largely geometrically driven. Others have tried to simplify the model further, going to toy models. One developed by some physicists in Spain has this picture, but turns out, interestingly, it's identical to a classical problem in mathematics going back two centuries. And what I want to do now, I want to move here to the area of special interest to this audience. The discussion I have pursued so far is essentially devoid of any physics. It's all geometry. It's almost the world's simplest model. You can play it on a computer very readily. The mathematics is more difficult to develop, but the key here is that geometry plays a fundamental role. There are certain scaling laws seen, for example, with respect to earthquakes. So-called B-value is a power law that has been measured and determined everywhere on the globe for earthquakes over the last half century. If the magnitude goes up by one unit, the number of events that are greater, that release greater energy, goes down by a certain amount. There's a scaling. And that scaling, the so-called B-value, is approximately one. The point, when I say that, what I want to mention is that this is absolutely independent of the geology that goes into the earthquakes. Whether you're looking at the San Andreas, whether you're looking at the Himalayas, whether you're looking at the Western Andes, none of the different geology, the different kind of rocks, the geometry of the how thrust the faults are interacting, is involved. It has only a minor effect. So again, the message here is that there can be phenomena which are absolutely different, but where geometry plays a fundamental role. This may tell us something. So because similar ideas, as I discussed earlier, having to do with forest fires, having to do with stress accumulation and earthquakes, have anything to do with human interaction. And in some sense, Lewis Fry Richardson is one of the best known individuals to have attacked this problem, but his work has remained largely unknown to people. He is best known as a hydrodynamicist and meteorologist. In some sense, he had a role in popularizing what has come to be known as fractals more than 60 years ago. It turns out he was a pacifist, Quaker who served in the First War, the French Friends Ambulance Service, in the French infantry. And he went on, after a career in hydrodynamics and meteorology, to try to analyze the nature of war by mathematical means. So crime, war, he tried in his analysis in his book, The Statistics of Deadly Quarrels, to look at this in some measure. And there are two curves that I want to present to you that he obtained, where he published data obtaining to gang warfare, first to Chicago gangland. And I want to emphasize that while I talked about spatial homogeneity and the like, if you imagine in the gang case, when you're recruiting in a given area, you're going to recruit basically from the predominant ethnicity, etc. So some of these issues can be overcome rather in a simple way. So the Irish versus Italian versus the Polish immigrant populations. And then to Manchukuo, the Japanese occupied Manchuria. We have tried in various ways to get hold of data for Los Angeles over the last several years without significant success.
I'm sorry, can you tell me what data, the size of the gang?
The size of the gang as for example, if we could obtain a listing of gangs and their sizes, then it could be sorted to present exactly the same pattern I'm showing on the screen now.
Excuse me, we have that in Long Beach, and there's www.streetgangs.org. That's all it did.
Alejandro Alonso, I have been working with for some time looking at this. He does not have quantitative data. He has maps, but not numbers. That's one of the problems. We need to quantify it. So, these two curves are not the cumulative distribution, but are essentially the first derivative of them. You'll see, so minus 2.3 would correspond to minus 1.3 in the previous graphs that I showed you, minus 2.29, 1.29, and that corresponds to forest fire with a very low sparking frequency. What is the outcome of this? We claim that it may be possible to understand this pattern of sizes from the simple geometrical model of recruitment, that may be sufficient to explain it. That if you have a pattern of recruitment wherein individuals join, if they become gang members and they're in isolation, they form the nucleus of what might become a gang as time evolves. But if they form in a location where they are adjacent to a pre-existing gang, they will become part of that network, part of that cluster. And that's a picture alone with random recruitment gives rise exactly to this structure. Yes?
Yours has a spatial stationarity. Like it says
homogeneity, yes.
Can you handle it with gang members being mobile temporally?
That will be very different from this picture.
Yeah, I know it will be, but that's a really tough question.
Yes. To introduce diffusion into
it,
for instance.
Yeah.
That is going to moderate this in very strong ways.
Yes.
In
principle, do you have any idea of how you might do that?
We have thought of doing this. In fact, that was part of a grant proposal we had a couple of years ago, which unfortunately wasn't funded. What we wanted to do was actually imagine an event where you're planting and recruiting at a site, and then allow that individual to migrate.
Yes.
Yes. That's what we proposed, and what we were not funded.
It's one of the things we have. We have forest fires, but we have gangs that are growing. They're highly,
yes,
they're highly mobile, but it's also associated with it. Our homicides used to be primarily between people who knew each other, or
I understand.
And we're moving more towards 50% stranger, which are gang on gang homicide. It's taking over the murder rate. But it's mobile gangs.
Once gangs start to move beyond ethnicity boundaries, everything is going to be incredibly messy. We thought about it. We proposed doing it, but haven't because we were not supported.
And that's what I wanted to ask you. How do you define? I mean, the space is going to be irregular, right? We can't divide up LA. I mean, I do have this data for parts of LA for long. If you go up to somewhere like Hollandbeck, you have a gang that occupies 17 different census block groups. You have a different gang that shares one block group with another gang.
Okay.
So
you can develop rules based on experience that you put into the computer models. The mathematical scaling will not apply, but the computer models, building in that intuition, could give you a lot of insight. And it's not that hard. You know, you can take literally a map and segment out different regions. You can carve it out. And then you can look at the recruitment process. And you can put in other variables, income, etc., because that affects it to some degree. Yeah?
So when you have contact between your susceptible individual and potential gang members, or he's converted in your model to probability one. Is that right?
Okay, could you repeat that again? That was okay.
So you have an isolated individual.
Yes.
Okay. And now you've got these other gang members that are around him.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
And so as time evolves, the pattern grows,
yes,
they come in contact. So you're assuming
you need
that he's converted with the probability one.
Yes, that's correct. Unless there are some intervening events.
Right. So for example, you might have somebody who was there and you tried to recruit him, became more negative against the gang, and so the network is rewired. And so now the network becomes adaptive.
We suggested the notion of, in quotes, and this is something I know absolutely nothing about, but an analog to a forest fire would be a police raid, that where there's a systematic, focused effort to eliminate a certain gang.
And you're arguing it would increase, it would reduce or increase the gang?
Depending on what the raid was.
Okay. There's nothing in this model that has anything to do with motivation.
I know, but if there's a police raid, mm-hmm. is the gang more coherent afterwards or less coherent?
If the raid destroys that gang, then by definition, it has been eliminated. Its competitors, however, would be free to invade that vacant territory.
And but is it more, the thing is, what I'm driving at is, there are about 15 or 20 fallacies that people are, pits people fall into when they deal with gangs, and they almost always fall into all of them. And you've not, so from what I can tell, you haven't fallen into them. And I can't understand why. I just tried to trap you.
Well, what I would like to submit here is that, okay, I gave you a very, very simple set of principles that one could use to build a model. It is a skeletal model. It's almost the simplest one could imagine constructing. Its value was that it did reproduce scalings that have been observed statistically in a couple other situations. But it also forms possibly a basis for, as a model, one can introduce into it more aspects of what is the real problem. The model is simple, you can introduce a greater degree of reality. It was designed to address a statistical scaling question and did that beautifully.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I mean, as we know, so, you know, a power law experiment, there are many different mechanisms that can give power laws. But you've got one here that is totally nearest neighbor.
That's right.
You know, on Wednesday afternoon, I'll show one that is the complete opposite. It's total connectivity and total mobility. It also gives an experiment, gives an experiment 2.5, exactly. So, I'm sure everyone here knows about power laws, but if they don't, then there's a whole list of models, of course, that give exponents.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, word of caution.
No, we appreciate that.
The type of model.
Analytically, if you pursue this and assume that the periphery of the gangs, forest clusters, etc., is smooth, you predict a slope of exactly -1. If, on the other hand, you have this fractal kind of irregularity and you input from numerical experiments what that fractal exponent is, this comes out directly. And I agree, this is directly an outcome of the specific rules. But
And so therein lies, you know, 2D, you know, I'm suddenly infecting someone next to me. It doesn't sound, and also a significant fraction of the grid is being infected in order to get scaling over. I mean, for your model to work, you've got to have scaling over these generations. You know,
that's
so
right.
Decades. You know, what fraction of the population are in a gang?
Okay.
You've got to
have an upper limit.
That's not
like
okay.
30%.
Yeah, that's not a question we have explored. Going back to the forest fire and especially the earthquake problem, there's a different statistic. That is, that the recurrence time and how it is redistributed for major events. And our model is able to reproduce that.
But we did homicide. We don't see a power for the inter-event time. I'll talk about
it. I understand.
Yeah.
There are similarities and differences. It's
I would like to relate this to a question raised earlier today about Michael Betty's work saying that the distribution of the city of the size in the U.S. follows this power law, but then Norfolk can the size of that increased significantly versus Los Angeles can go fast, grow very fast. I think the power law basically is a global measure. It measures the entire system. It's one index. You cannot use that to represent the actual geographic distribution. I think the same problem is here. I mean, globally, you can generate a summary of statistics that follows perfectly to the power law. But if you're dealing with individual neighborhoods, you don't know what happens in each neighborhood. So it's just like you have two maps. You want to compare how similar these two maps are. I mean, you can calculate Morant's eye. These two layers may have the same Morant's eye, but they look drastically different. So I'm not sure whether we are mixing the two.
I think an important point that emerges from your concern is this. With the simplest set of assumptions, we are able to derive certain of the large bulk features statistically that are observed. What I believe is very possible is that by taking the underlying assumptions and modifying them to incorporate geographical variability of the baseline population, etc., build in mobility, put in a freeway network, in principle, all this is doable. And what I'm trying to argue is that cellular automata models, beginning from this very simple picture, could provide a very rich set of tools for approaching the very real specific problems you have in mind.
You know, small gains, it's easy to see how recruitment would be done locally and so on, but once gains get larger, they build hierarchical structures, and the command can decide where they want to recruit, and therefore deviate from this type of a structure.
Of course, of course.
We've seen that, looks like it, from the data, I think, the study in New Jersey watching those gains develop new cells.
But so I would argue the contrary. Because I would argue that the use of the same name is an illusion, and that the names like words like gang, Crips, Bloods, and Latin Kings are used for entirely different gangs that don't know each other, that even fight each other, but they become proper name. What sounds like a proper name, a noun, is actually a common noun, and that there's an illusion. The gang maps create an illusion of much more structure than is there. The hierarchy, the researchers over and over again find the hierarchy either is not there or is grossly exaggerated, that the gangs are not that stable, and that the membership isn't that stable. The gangs don't last that long. And the other thing is that police very rarely drop anybody's name or any gang name from a computer. So that what happens is it appears that if you're a gang member, if you join a gang at age 12, you're in the gang the rest of your life because they never take you off the computer.
And again, out in the work that we've done in East Los Angeles, one of the gangs that we focused on, Cal Gangs, had 340 members. When we talked to probation, when we talked to the community, when we talked to the police that were familiar with this area, there might not be a structure, but or a hierarchy, but there are clearly actors who are more active than, we reduced that to 27 from 340. So what does it mean that you have a gang that's 340, but 27 other people are active on the street?
Now, I appreciate that point. You're trying to introduce a greater degree of realism.
Yeah.
And but what I'm trying to suggest as well is these models are amenable to it. And much of the discussion brings to mind some work done in mathematical epidemiology relating to the bubonic plague and its spread in 1347-48. And there were efforts made by a number of historians, anthropologists, and the like to identify in different months the progress of the plague as it spread from North Africa into Europe. And as you look at the maps, the spread was not uniform. But as the infected individuals, as the regions were introduced into the Alps and into northern Italy, etc., there was a slowdown. And I remember one thing that blew me away when I first saw one of the articles on this, is that there was an effort to extrapolate the results. This says something about blind mathematics. across the Mediterranean by having dotted lines. So one has to take a large grain of salt, the models, the simplicity there, and build into them the complexity you need to answer the specific questions you have.
Yep. To what extent do you have robustness results? So you have this simple model that produces a very nice answer, but to what extent, if you do modify the rules, are there theorems that say, as you modify the rules, the picture doesn't change very much?
You've raised an important question using basically a variant of the Picard theorem. We can show our results to be very robust. Complicate the model, I don't know the answer to that. There will be breaking of the scaling in certain places. That's almost certain.
So it's robust under what? I mean, what kind of changes are you allowed to make and still?
We had scale breaking only at the largest scales because for the physical problems we were looking at, the nature of the universe, if you will, changed. And there was a physical limit to how large the system could be. And so at that point it broke down.
It seems like numbers in the 20th century Japan is probably a pretty good indication of killing power or the ability to inflict damage. But we talk about like some of the gangs now in LA or different things here. If you get a small number of people with a lot of money, a lot of resources, they could inflict a large amount of damage. So is gang size in terms of numbers really the measure we should be looking at?
Well, again, our picture assumes homogeneity. And you're arguing for the need for something radically different from that.
Well, no, it's just the fact that some people will be able to inflict more damage with fewer people than other people with large groups might not be able to be such a problem. I mean, it makes sense, I think, in 40th century Japan, because you go one sword and you kill one person. But I think it may be a little bit different in LA at the moment.
Okay. The question is, in principle, these models can be made richer by allowing for that.
Yeah,
but there's no simple way to predict what it would do.
So it's difficult to take that model and put it into current day?
I won't say it's difficult. We were able, in our model, some of the results I showed, we had introduced over a billion elements. We had a population base, if you will, that was larger, many times larger than the, hundreds of times larger than the area involved. If you reduce that richness and allow instead for a descriptor of each of those sites and certain variables associated with it, income, motivational issues, transportation, access, etc. In principle, it is doable.
But you don't know if you get a power loss that necessarily will.
It may. Only by doing the experiment can you find out.
And cellular automata can be done in color with rules for how the colors propagate.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You have black and white, so.
Some of the. Here, we were looking at nine orders of hierarchy in the networks that formed. And so the largest to smallest in this case varied by more than a factor of 1,000.
So you could take account ability to inflict damage by putting a certain color or shade of color in the cell.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is doable.
Yeah.
Now, as as thinking as an applied mathematician, the interest is more trying to identify the scaling, but to make this relevant, these issues can and be put in, and it's not hard.
Let me approach this from the opposite, and I don't know how easy it is for me to characterize it, but for me, what I particularly like about your presentation is it helps me deal with my general discomfort with the whole gang notion to begin with. And what it helped me think about is you're presenting an argument that the gang size could be just a simple function of simple geometry, the recruiting process, a random process. And what that argument says is that if anyone has a more complex argument, they have to, in some sense, use yours as the null hypothesis.
Yes.
Say, can you,
yes.
Does your new idea, your more complex idea, do anything greater for the explanatory power than this very simple process?
Okay.
And I think I found that actually quite helpful in thinking about this stuff.
Now, Occam's razor is an important device.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas various models can produce different power laws, the fact that this simple model produces one that is very robust,
mm-hmm.
with this incredibly simple underlying set of assumptions, and corresponds to observations, that, to my mind, presents something of an argument saying that these other factors may not be all that important.
I think that's a very important thing.
That's a problem where you have multiple solutions for a given problem. This may be the simplest solution, in part, for one particular problem, but it doesn't guarantee it's the one.
Any other questions? About time for one more. Okay, Jeff?
This number, what is it, 0.59 is a proportion of, in this case, is sort of the point at which you get percolation.
That's right.
Is that correct? Would it be fair to say that in this simple model, that this that's the point of, let's say, gang recruitment where you would end up with super gangs in the environment?
Ah, okay. Well, that's a very intriguing question because in many regards, a lot of issues of the sort can be looked at in simple linear or relatively simple nonlinear ways. But here, with percolation, the idea that there can be a critical density, that there are events that can take on absolutely different behavior, when you that is something our intuition does not help us much deal with. My collaborator, Kellis Borok, using some notions in complexity theory, published a series of papers where he claimed that this kind of critical event could impact a number of sociological and economic systems. And it's an intriguing and also terrifying idea. It's intriguing because we're suggesting there could be very different behaviors, and terrifying that we have no idea what to do with it.